This is The Story of Mom, Season 2, Episode 1. Thanks for listening, you guys. This whole season, I am going to focus on the pressure that surrounds motherhood. And I'm going to talk to different neurobiologists, professors, experts, and we're just going to peel back the layers, take a look, see what's going on, figure out what that anxiety is all about, and probably learn some stuff. That's pretty cool. So let's get to it. We're going to talk to my first guest. Her name is Dr. Ann West, and she's probably studying brains right now at Duke University as I sit here in Los Angeles, pondering what it all means, but not really doing anything more about it other than this podcast. Hi, guys. So I'm here with Dr. Ann West, who's an associate professor at Duke University School of Medicine. She's a neurobiologist who studies epigenetics and the brain. Hi, Dr. Ann West.
Hi, Shelley. How are you?
I'm really good. Thank you so much for talking with me about this very complex topic of epigenetics.
I'm excited.
Yay. Okay, so what is epigenetics? And you can answer this on a small scale and on a big scale, if you're able.
Yeah, so epigenetics is such an interesting word right now. It means a lot of different things to different people. And I think a lot of times when people think about epigenetics, they think about a couple of things, and one of them is twins. Here's the idea that you can know two twins, and they might be identical twins, so that they have the same DNA, but they're different. Twins aren't always exactly the same. They look a little bit different. They may behave a little bit differently. And that's one of the places where people sometimes begin to think about, well, how can it be if the twins are genetically identical, that there's anything different about them, that there must be something else, something that's on top of or in addition to the genome. And that's what the word epi means. It means on top of genetics or more than genetics. So that's one way that epigenetics sometimes comes up in the world. But the other is this idea that there might be things about the environment that change the way that our genes work. And in order to understand that, because, I mean, that could be so many different things, this idea of nature and nurture. What is the nurture part of the environment? It doesn't necessarily have to be that all of this is the same thing. And so to try and understand how that relates to the word epigenetics, I think it's useful to actually understand the history of where the word came from.
Oh, yeah.
So the word kind of started in the early part of the last century by a developmental biologist who was looking actually at how eggs develop. And this was a guy named Waddington, and he figured out that sometimes one part of an organism, a cell, a little piece of it, that what that cell became was influenced by what it was near. And this was the idea that a particular cell might be influenced by its environment to become one thing or another. So, for instance, if you think of how humans develop, we all start as a fertilized egg. And yet that single cell, that single fertilized egg, is going to become all the different parts of the body as it divides. It's going to become brain cells in the brain. It's going to become liver cells in the liver. And so how do you take one cell and make it into all these different things? That was sort of the original idea, that there must be something different because all those cells have the same, we know this now, genome. He didn't know that at the time, actually. He didn't know what the source of genetic information was at the time that he came up with this idea, but he knew there had to be something about the environment that can make cells different. So did you want to
ask? Oh, yeah. So is the genome what makes the cells different? Is it? Can you describe what the genome is?
Yeah, so this was the next sort of piece of the history, right?
Okay,
so in the 50s, people find out, so this is the famous discovery by Watson and Crick that won the Nobel Prize, was discovering that DNA was the genetic material of cells. So this is deoxyribonucleic acid, this big fancy name. Mm-hmm. But it's a particular kind of stuff, and this is the stuff of the genes that are in every cell in your body. And those genes are what allows one organism to make the next organism. So as you pass on your genes to your offspring, you're giving them your DNA through these, through the egg and the sperm, the cells that create new organisms. So that was the big discovery in the 50s, was that DNA in the nucleus of a cell, the center of the cell, is what is the genes and what carries genetic information from one generation to the next generation. And so once that was discovered, it was pretty straightforward, right? If you have a particular gene that encodes for a particular disease and you pass it on to your offspring, for instance, they're likely to have that disease as well.
Right.
But the interesting thing was, we all know that sometimes it's not quite so simple. So going back to identical twins, they have exactly the same DNA and exactly the same genes, and yet they're not exactly the same. They're really similar, but they can be a little bit different. And disease is a good example. Sometimes twins might both have some increased risk for disease, but they don't necessarily both get a particular disease, like heart disease or diabetes, for instance.
Right.
They might be more vulnerable or more resilient to getting that disease. So again, there was this idea, there's got to be something beyond just the DNA that influences even disease risk. Hmm. And so it was in the 70s then that it was discovered that there were actually additional things on top of the DNA. So here's that word epi on top of genetics coming back again. So an actual mechanism. So we had this idea, this sort of concept that there was something beyond the genes. But in the 70s, it was discovered an actual mechanism, a kind of biochemical modification, something that happens in the cells that changes the DNA. And this was DNA methylation. So methyl groups are little chemical molecules that are in your body. They're used in your body for lots of things. And they can be added to DNA. Mm. And DNA can have them or not have them. And it turns out they can be passed on when cells divide, just like the DNA sequence can be passed from one cell to the next. Mm. So here was the idea, taking that concept from what we learned about how the genome works, and now we learn that there's a mechanism by which the epigenome, this actual physical thing, the modification of DNA, can be passed from one organism to the next as well. Mm. And that modification of DNA is something that might be changed by the environment. And that's actually the big advance of sort of the modern period of time in the past decade or so, is the discovery that DNA methylation is actually modified by, say, experiences or exposure to chemicals, things like that. Mm-hmm. So DNA is kind of fixed. We always think of that as a set thing. You have a particular set of DNA and that's what you got. But DNA methylation can change based on what happens to you in the world. Hmm. And so here was the idea of perhaps this is the mechanism that describes how nurture can change nature. Mm-hmm. That's why the people were so excited about this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which totally makes sense for, like, motherhood.
Exactly.
and all of those things. Mm-hmm.
Now, the deal is that over time, then, we have these two concepts of what is epigenetics. We have sort of one social concept, right? Nature, nurture. We all can see this as you were talking about, maybe how a mother interacts with her child could be a kind of nurturing that could influence that child's, you know, how their disease risk, for instance, growing up. But we have this other concept of the word epigenetics, which is this very specific mechanistic biological thing, which is DNA methylation, a specific kind of modification that happens at certain places in DNA. Mm. And there's also, it turns out, many other kinds of biochemical modifications, not just of the DNA itself, but of the proteins that wrap DNA into its intricate structures. And it's those structures that are different between different types of cells. Mm. And so that concept of the structure of DNA is what is extremely important in terms of its function. I was trying to think of a good example of this, and I thought it might be an example like, say you had a book and it had a bunch of chapters in it. but one of the chapters in the book, you had put a paperclip over the top of the chapter. So it's closed. It's closed off. So the book, all the information is still there, mm-hmm. but you never wind up reading that chapter because mm-hmm. the pages are all stuck together. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what it's like, how chromatin structure, the structure of the DNA in different cells makes them have different information because some of the chapters are squished together. So that cell isn't actually reading that chapter.
Wow. And what is it that squishes them together? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it actually is physically squished together. That is what it looks like.
Wow.
So the DNA can be actually sort of bound up tightly in a little knot such that it can't turn. DNA doesn't do anything on its own until it's read by proteins in the cell. It is essentially the instruction manual for how to build the parts of the cell. And so if it's squished together and it can't be read by the machinery of the cell, it never gets turned into those structures. So it never acts on the cell and makes the cell do anything. So what makes a neuron in the brain different from a liver cell is the fact that the neuron instructions are open inside neurons, and so they get turned into proteins, which are the sort of pieces of the cell that make it do all the work. And you don't ever make those pieces in the liver, so the liver doesn't do the same thing.
Right. Okay.
So here's the idea of how that structure, that biochemical structure, has a function is by making different parts of the cell. And we know that to be true. So we understand what the mechanism is and what it does. But we don't really understand how that epigenetic mechanism, how that regulation of the genome mechanism relates to the social concept of why are twins sometimes different from one another.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big gap between those two concepts of the word epigenetics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people are trying to figure out, how they relate to each other, but realize there's these two ideas out there, and not everything that's epigenetics at the molecular level, at the mechanistic level inside cells, might be epigenetics at this broader nature-nurture level.
Hmm. So fascinating. Okay, so scientists basically are working to figure that out.
Yeah, exactly.
What is it? Neurobiologists.
Epigenetics.
Epigenetics scientists. Okay. Amazing.
So people who are doing neuroepigenetics are essentially trying to figure out how does that defined biochemical mechanism of making the genes be functional in a certain way, how does that relate to interesting things that the brain does? And the interesting thing the brain does is it guides behavior, and that's what we're interested in.
Mm.
So we want to understand how we learn. I mean, what gets me up in the morning is I got really excited. I remember when I was first learning about neurobiology that the concept was that your brain changes when you learn something.
Mm-hmm.
So just like if you work out, your muscles get bigger.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same idea that when you learn something new, your brain actually changes its structure and you make more connections between neurons.
So
the pieces in the brain actually change the way that they're connected together. You know, the brain is a little bit strange. You only have so many neurons. You have more neurons when you're born, actually, than you do later in life. It's a little, exact timing is a little complicated to explain, but the idea is it's not like you can get smarter by making a lot more cells in your brain. You have to work with what you have.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's why we think epigenetics might be so important in the brain,
because
mm-hmm. you have these cells for your entire life. It can be 100 years you have the same cells.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they have to do all sorts of different things as you learn and as you change and as you move environments.
Mm-hmm.
Your brain has to behave differently.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that by making different pieces. And that parts list, again, is the genome. And how you turn that parts list into making all those different parts is through epigenetics. You regulate what you build in each neuron differently.
Mm-hmm.
So this process is really important for changing your behavior
mm-hmm.
In response to the things you learn.
Mm-hmm.
But understanding exactly how and to what degree, that's the part that we're trying to understand.
So interesting. And I'm even thinking about, like, in therapy, how people learn to, like, if they have a negative pattern of thinking, they learn a positive
right.
pattern of thinking. And ultimately, what I'm hearing you say, I'm going to say this and I
mm-hmm.
might be totally wrong, is that is actually using the genome to change? Well, it's changing
it, that? It could be.
Okay.
It could be, right?
Okay.
So actually thinking, so what I'll tell you what we can do, and this will help explain maybe my response to your question why I said it could be.
Okay.
So what we can do, the hard part in people is that people don't like you taking their brains to look at the biochemistry,
right.
Which is a very good thing. You know, people need their brains. So if we're going to understand a biochemical mechanism, we have to be able to see it. Mm. And we're actually really well able to see this in model organisms. So when we talk about models, it means that we're asking a question about an interesting process that might be happening, say, in humans. But because we can't get brain tissue from humans very easily, we work with some other organism and ask the question a different way.
Mm.
So we do a lot of our studies in mice because mice are pretty smart. They can learn things very easily.
Mm-hmm.
So we can study interesting behaviors in the mice.
Mm-hmm.
But we are still able in mice to actually then look at their brains and look at these specific processes like, say, DNA methylation,
mm-hmm.
where we have to take the brain out to be able to see it.
Wow.
So we're able to look at that process or change that process in a mouse. And then we can understand how that relates to the behavior because we can look at the behavior as well.
Wow.
And so in some cases, it turns out what we tend to look at is we look at cases where the mouse might have, say, been exposed to something. A lot of the work that we do is working in my lab, is working on drug addiction. This is a big problem, obviously. And when people are exposed to drugs of abuse, those drugs act on the brains to change them for very long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
So the people, once they become addicted, it becomes extremely hard for them to stop taking the drug because, as you were saying, their behavior becomes fixed. And that's because their brain has become fixed in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to understand that process because we'd like to try to solve that problem. We'd like to make it so that people who are addicted to drugs could reset their brains in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the stimulus that we look at. We look at when you give a drug to an animal or the animal takes the drug, how does its brain change? And one of the things we've found, as of many labs, have found that these drugs can, for instance, change those biochemical marks on the DNA. So this is the case where it is clear that that kind of experience can change the epigenome.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does, then it's going to change that parts list.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to understand how pliable is that? How fixed does it become? Can we change it? If it becomes fixed in a certain way, can you erase those marks, take them away?
Totally.
And then would that have an effect on the behavior?
Totally.
So now in this case, we have control over what we're asking the mouse to do. The mouse takes the drug, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
When you were giving your example of a person who's undergoing therapy and thinking is a really great way, actually, to change the same kind of chemicals in your brain that are changed by these drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So drugs of abuse tap into the normal chemical nature of the brain and alter it. When you're thinking, you're actually also altering your own neurochemical composition.
Mm-hmm.
So it's perfectly reasonable to consider that thinking, like in therapy, could change these marks as well. It's just that we don't know it because we can't do therapy with the mice.
Right. Right.
We could, but we don't know what they're thinking.
Right.
So so that's why we can't really ever, it's almost impossible to make the claim that therapy is tapping into epigenetics. You'll never know.
Right.
But would it be reasonable to assume that it could be? It's reasonable to suggest that it could be.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
No, I totally get it. And even like I'm thinking about motherhood and, you
mm-hmm.
know, people say that the way your parents talk to you is the way you grow up talking to yourself. I don't know if you've ever
right.
heard that, but like
all
of those things make sense. And one thing that I think is like the best news about all of this is that it's dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
So even
right.
if things become fixed, like are you finding in your work that if things become fixed, that they can be shifted again? Are you finding those results, or I don't know?
Absolutely. Okay. And actually, so there's two things that are really exciting in there. And you, we had talked about sort of what was the third question was, you know, why is epigenetics important? Yeah. And I think it's important for exactly this idea. So it's really important for two reasons. So epigenetics as a concept is important first because, just biologically speaking, this is how you take a single genome and do different things with it. So it's just fundamentally important for life and how it works. And so now that we understand this mechanism, we know a lot more about how cells work than we did before. But the other reason that it's important is because it offers this possibility of change. It says that genetics is not necessarily destiny, right? But that it emphasizes the possibility that you can change the way that, you know, any organ in your body works, be it cancer, be it aging, or be it some fixed behaviors based on the way the brain is structured. Mm-hmm. And so this is a very progressive idea, so it has all these nice, you know, sort of ideas about change that we like. And so this is helpful and hopeful for dealing with a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the question of is it more than just an idea? Is it actually possible? And I think one of the most exciting things that occurred in the past couple of decades was the discovery that you can take, remember how we talked about this idea that you start out, all of us start out as a single cell, we're all initially just an egg, and then we become all these different parts, like our hearts and our minds, our hearts and our brains, the different parts that do different things. Mm-hmm. Well, about 15, 20 years ago, a scientist in Japan, whose last name is Yamanaka, discovered that you can actually take cells that have already become one kind of cell, and you can de-differentiate them. You can make them go backwards to a state where they can now become other kinds of cells. We used to think it was a one-directional process. Oh, wow. You start as an egg, and then you become all these different parts. And that you couldn't take those parts, and you can't just take a brain cell and make a new organism from it. You make it from an egg. You make eggs, and more sperm can make more organisms. Mm-hmm. But you can now take a skin cell from a person, and you can turn that skin cell into a muscle cell, into a nerve cell.
Right.
And that wasn't thought to be done before. And that is exactly targeting the epigenome. Because as we said, the whole idea of the biochemical epigenome is these marks on the DNA that take it and squish parts of it together and open other parts of it up so that you're reading different instructions in different cells. And we found, you know, back to the paperclip analogy, we found you can take those paperclips off and you can put them in new places.
I wondered about that. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, exactly how well it works is another question, right? But it is possible. And I think for a long time, people weren't sure it was possible.
Right.
But it is possible.
Wow.
So to me, that was totally transformative.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, what does that have to do about whether or not that has any relevance for addiction? It's not clear, right? For behavioral changes, for personality, how malleable is that? Well, that has a lot more to do with a lot of things that are not only just bookmarking different pages of the gene instructions, right? It has to do with a lot of things.
Right.
That's one piece of the puzzle. It's not everything.
Right.
But it is maybe part of the puzzle.
Right. Right. Totally. On the inside, because behavior could maybe continue in a way that.
Of course. So there's lots more things that, you know, behavior is based on than just the parts list in any given neuron. But that is part of it, and it is one of the ways you can change it.
Oh, that's so fascinating. And I want to make sure that I have a clear understanding of what you do specifically in your lab. I heard mice and addiction and all of these things, but tell me more.
Yeah. So what we specifically do in the lab is we take questions in animal behavior that we want to try to understand the relevance for this kind of gene regulation process. And we train the mice to do these behaviors, and then we do two things. So one of the things that we do is we look at when the animal is learning a behavior or getting exposed to some sort of environmental change. We look and see what that does to the epigenome of certain kinds of cells in the brain, certain kinds of neurons. And so here's the idea of we're asking the first part of the question, can something in the world change the way the genome is regulated? Mm-hmm. So that's the first part of what we do. And the way we do that, you know, the real advance there all came from the Human Genome Project. You may have heard about the Human Genome Project, which was, you know, a huge project during the 1990s where we sequenced the human genome. But a side effect of that project was that we as a community built all these sequencers, and then after the human genome was done, we realized we had to have something to do with the sequencers. And so people developed ways to sequence and look at the epigenome itself and the function of the epigenome. So all those marks, where are they laid down on the DNA, and what are they, and how do they change the way the DNA works? So that's what we do, is we do a ton of very specialized sequencing, reading out what's happening in all those neurons in your brain at this very specific biochemical and molecular level. So we can look at the landscape. We often talk about the landscape of the marks that are laid down in the structure of the DNA in given cells. So we can see how it's different, and we can see how it changes.
Yes, totally. And is that under a microscope?
No, it's actually difficult to explain, because it would be a lot easier. Okay. There are things you can do under a microscope, and people do that. But it would be a lot easier to explain if it didn't have to go through so many steps.
Yeah, gotcha.
And so, yeah, it's very indirect the way that we see it.
Okay.
I'm trying to think. I don't know if I can come up with a good analogy.
Okay.
I think that we view it as a landscape, because the way that we represent the data that we see is the genome sequence, the sequence of the DNA in your cells and anybody's cells, can be drawn as a series of letters from left to right.
Yes.
It's like a book.
Yes.
It's just like a book. Mm. And if you can imagine that on top of that book, on top of each of the words of the book, you put a little colored circle of a different size, depending on whether it was modified by a particular kind of, say, methylation, like DNA methylation. If you put a circle wherever the DNA methylation was, and the size of the circle represented how much there was, mm-hmm. you can imagine you could look at a page in a book and you'd see a pattern of bigger and smaller circles.
Mm-hmm.
And that pattern is essentially the landscape. It's the distribution of that mark in space. And so that's the way that we would look at the data and how
that's
we'd
great.
See it. And we can look at how those patterns are different between different cells or between different conditions.
Mm.
And what we know that that means is that, you know, that it means that we're reading out that parts list in a different way.
That's great. Yeah.
So that's one thing that we do, but that's all very descriptive. It's kind of, it's fun. You get a lot of information. You're like, ooh, look at that. That's interesting. I wonder if,
uh-huh.
but it's what we call hypothesis generating, right?
Uh-huh.
So you look at this data and you say, oh, I wonder if that means that it works this way.
Uh-huh.
But what we really like to do is we like to test hypotheses. We like to change. We like to say, well, we think that this is important, so we're going to go change that thing and we're going to see what happens.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what we're doing now. And this is what we call sort of molecular genetics.
Oh, my gosh. And I'm curious to know if any of this has changed how you are as a mother for your children.
How has it changed how I am as a mother for my children? You know, I think that it's definitely the case. I think all of us are like this, right? How many kids do you have?
I have two kids.
And so if you have two kids, I think it really becomes the difference between, I think genetics really becomes clear to you. I don't know. The kids are not the same, even though they have the same parents. You look at them and you go, wow, how can two kids with the same parents be so different?
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think we're all aware sometimes of these things.
Uh-huh.
The question is, how do you break it down if you know some fact? Obviously, you know a lot about your kids just from watching them.
Uh-huh.
And so as scientists, we often joke about how science influences the way that we look at our kids, because I study, you know, development. And so I remember when my kids were little, there's things we do with the mice, a task that we do with the mice, and we see our kids do this. I remember one of them is we study novelty, because novelty is one of those things that taps into that chemistry I was talking about, the drugs of abuse tap into. It's a molecule called dopamine that's active in your brain. So we often take mice and we expose them to novel things, because novelty turns on dopamine in the brain. And so we do a task called novel object exploration, and you put mice in a box and you watch if they like, you give them little toys. We actually give them toys. And you see if they go to the new toy instead of the old toy. Right, because they like new toys. Mice like new toys.
Yes.
So I remember one time my son, my little one, had a basket of toys, big basket, and, you know, there's 100 toys. But there was one new toy in there, because we'd been to McDonald's or something, dumped the basket on the floor, and he went like a beeline for the one new toy out of the 100. And I was amazed at that. So you can see these things. So I did, admittedly, that was a case where I really thought about it in a scientific context. I suspect that understanding epigenetics and genetics does make you think that that there's more change. It might make you motivated to work harder to change something.
Yeah.
Say if your child was having difficulty learning, you might be less inclined to believe that they would not be able to learn, and more inclined to say, I just need to change the way that this is presented. And I think it's that hope and that progress, that sense of changeability, that I think can have a really positive impact on people. Again, whether this mechanism is the one that's actually underlying it is less important than how that causes people to behave. I suspect it makes me different, but it's so hard to know because I can't do the control.
Totally. I experiment on yourself. Absolutely. I totally get that. And I think that that concept of hope, even when one runs into issues, and that idea that, like, as parents, it's all dynamic, is so powerful. It's so powerful. So,
Has it ever made you, has it ever made it more difficult for you? Like, would you ever feel like the concept that the epigenome is dynamic would make you worry that things could change too much?
I haven't gone that far with it. No, I think for me, I'm just so excited about it. And, you know, I've looked at things like growth mindset, where you can, you know, be open. And I don't know, I think, I get that thought, though, because as parents, it's constantly evolving, and you'll have these times where you're like, we're all doing amazing and everybody's rocking it, and then there'll be the next thing.
Let's just stay right where we are.
You can't. It's constantly changing. So I get that thought, though. I do get that thought.
Yeah.
And you don't have any control.
I'm just curious.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a good question. It's a really good question. Scary.
So we have hit on most of the things I had written down.
I thank you so much for this. This is lovely. So
I hope it was useful.
Yeah, it definitely. I'm excited. I feel like I'm experiencing dopamine, because this is all like a new toy. As soon as you said that, I was like, oh my gosh, absolutely. That's going on for me right now. So thank you so much.
Yeah, I hope it was helpful.
It's wonderful. So I just want to say, based on all of this, when you look at the concept of epigenetics, there is as much pressure on parenthood to make the right choices with your children and not set off their genes in a destructive manner based on the behavior that you have towards them. But there's also just as much pressure in that direction as there is freedom. Because in the concept of epigenetics, it means nothing is fixed. Nothing's set in stone. Everything can shift around. And that also can be applied to your own childhood. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you to Dr. Ann West. That's our show. Please email me at thestoryofmom@gmail.com or find me on the interwebs, also at thestoryofmom.com.